This week in Retronauts, we update your podcast feed. One ping only. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. You know, because you ping like an RSS feed. Okay, anyway. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am a man who does not take a dump without a plan. Who else do we have here on the podcast with me this week to talk about a B-tier 80s classic of cinema and possibly a Z-tier classic of video games, although perhaps one of you will disagree. Let's start with the person on the same continent with me at the moment.
I think that's me. Hi, I'm Ray Barnholt.
None of us are actually in a submarine at the moment, although I imagine the acoustics in there would be terrible. You know, actually, that would just give away our presence. All the sound we create podcasting, and the enemy would be able to track us down. Good old Jonesy with his headphones, he'd be like, oh, I feel like someone's just talking a mile a minute there. Yeah, so no podcasting.
Jeremy, don't use up all your movie references just now. You get a whole episode.
There's so many. One of the reasons that this episode has to happen is just because the central pillar of this property, the movie that so many millions of people have seen, is one of those, like I said, B-tier 80s classics like Die Hard and Predator, also by the same director. It's just rife with references and punchy dialogue and just memorable moments that that endure 35 years on, nearly. Anyway, so that's my excuse for rambling a lot and making lots of references in the first 3 minutes. Let's also introduce our third and final member of this trifecta, this power trio, all the way from the little old town of Osaka.
Hello, everyone. This is Diamond Fight, and nothing of what you are about to hear ever happened.
It's true. This episode has already been redacted. Anyway, yes, in case you couldn't tell from all of the references we've been dropping and also the title of this podcast in the feed, we are talking about The Hunt for Red October because the book turns 40 years old this year, which is absolutely wild to think about. But time keeps doing that. It keeps, you know, moving forward and making things older. So it seems kind of inevitable. But there is, you know, a video game tie-in component to the film and the book and so on and so forth. I don't actually have anything good to say about those games, but I'm hoping that maybe
no spoilers.
One of the two of you, possibly both of you, can change my feelings. But at the very least, it's a fun chance to talk about a media property that has been very influential in some surprising ways, even beyond, you know, just the immediate video game tie-ins of The Hunt for Red October. The overall sort of intellectual property empire that this launched continues to resonate throughout video games. And I really doubt that we will ever necessarily have a Rainbow Six podcast episode, but maybe, I don't know. So the kids do like their Rainbow Six Siege even now. So it might be worth looking back.
I bet you get Dan Chu on here to do like a Splinter Cell talk, right?
Oh yeah, I mean Splinter Cell for sure. I mean, there you go. Like we're referencing all these major properties that all kind of, in a way, got their start with The Hunt for October. So I feel that to explain how that is the case, we need to answer the question, who is Thomas L. Clancy? It sounds like the name of a very fancy lad. And actually, I feel like that's actually kind of where he got his start. He's from Towson, Maryland, which my sister-in-law lives there. And I can tell you, it is full of fanciness. It is a very fancy place.
I see. I'm just glad he's not like Mavis Beacon, you know, just made up person that was, you know, responsible for a bunch of computer games.
Well, you know, I think there are two Tom Clancys. I think there is the author of The Hunt for Red October, the actual human, and then I think there is Tom Clancy, the
Tom Clancy's.
Yes. Yeah, the guy who he has the grocer's apostrophe, and that's how you can tell it's not really him.
It's perpetual apostrophe in death.
He was like, "Wouldn't it be fun to have a guy with some like green lights on his forehead?" All right, you folks go make a video game about that, and that is how you get Tom Clancy apostrophe. Yes, correct. Anyway, before we start, I guess I should ask, have either of you read many of Clancy's novels, or do you know him mostly through video games and movies?
It's got to be the entertainment media other than books. Yeah, I've not really read any of the books. I've, of course, seen the film we're going to talk about today, and I've played a couple of Splinter Cell games and dallied with some of the other sorts of ones around that universe. And so, yeah. I have a light informational store about it.
The Clancyverse. Diamond?
Yeah.
I'm positive that at some point, either right after watching this movie or maybe one of the sequels, I got really interested. Like, well, this guy writes a lot of books. I wonder what these books are like. And I'm pretty sure I went to the library and I grabbed Hunt for October and I started to read it. And I was like, I cannot enjoy this. It is just, you know, as we'll get into later, you know, he wrote a book based on a lot of study. You know, he did the man did his homework. You can say a lot about him, but he did his homework. He wrote this incredibly dense text. Apparently, the publisher actually told him to cut like 100 pages at one point because it was just it was so dense. But let me tell you, what's left there is still like a chocolate layer cake folded inside of a chocolate layer cake inside of a cast iron submarine, and like you just. I remember
that sounds, you know, so much better than a nuclear submarine. I would eat a chocolate cake submarine. Absolutely.
I tried, you know, in my youth when I was, you know, very, very open to new ideas. I couldn't do it. So I don't know. I'm sure the man must have fans. These books still sell. There's still books out there with his name on it and they're still selling, but I couldn't.
Yes,
do it.
He's been dead. And yet somehow new Tom Clancy apostrophe S books just keep showing up. No, I actually did read several of his novels back, starting before The Hunt for Red October actually became a film.
Wow.
I would say a year or two before that. It was just, not that I'm like some sort of, you know, progressive, cutting edge media awareness type guru here. Just, you know, Hunt for Red October was really big in the sort of waning days of Reagan's America. And actually, it was Ronald Reagan who is pretty much single-handedly responsible for this book becoming something other than an esoteric footnote by some sort of overly ambitious military wonk who wrote for a private press. Reagan said he enjoyed reading the book, and so, of course, his many acolytes such as Paul Harvey or whoever, immediately rushed out and said, wow, we need to read this book. So I would kind of put his fiction in the same category. It's somewhere between like a James Michener and a Dan Brown. So on one hand, you have like James Michener writing just these massive historical, political, James Clavell also, like Shogun. But Michener would write things like Texas, and the book was actually the size of Texas. It deforested an entire continent for one single copy. It was massive, ponderous, dull. He puts the ponderous and ponderosa, thank you. But you know, very, very intricate plotting, very extensive timelines, lots of characters, kind of, you know, Game of Thrones, but nonfiction. And then, of course, you have Dan Brown, who I would say is actually a descendant, literarily, of Tom Clancy, writing things that are based in socio-political, religious fact, but then spun into extreme fiction, meant to be page turners. Dan Brown is kind of like Tom Clancy, but is more of a crowd pleaser. Tom Clancy is still pretty Like, his books, as Diamond said, are very dense. But they do have punchy dialogue, unlike, you know, Michener or Clavell. Very, like, I feel like when they made the movie, they didn't have to work too hard to make the characters likable and the events memorable. Because, you know, underneath the layers of political intrigue and submarine technology, you do have, you know, a pretty solid, well-developed cast of characters. I think the movie is a much more interesting experience because, one, it's much briefer. Two, it's got Sean Connery. And three, they just excised a lot of the really minor characters that don't do much to really move the story forward. They're just kind of there as flavor. Anyway, so it was a pretty good book. I mean, I would really compare The Hunt for Red October in a way to Moby Dick, and not just because they're about things hunting for things below the water. Moby Dick was also, I don't know if you've read the unabridged Moby Dick or just the abridged version, but the unabridged Moby Dick is pretty much what The Hunt for Red October would have been if the editor had not said, we don't need all this stuff. There are entire chapters of Moby Dick that have nothing to do with the story. It's just like, hey, here's how whaling works.
Yeah.
Here's how we kill a whale. Here's how it works to be on a boat. It's just like all of his research notes, Melville's research notes, or I guess personal experience notes, are just right there in the text. And so usually when they give that novel to you in high school, they're like, here's the version without the 100 pages of technical stuff. And it's still, you know, a little bit of a slog at times, but much more readable than if you went the full length. So yeah, I'm making a lot of comparisons between Clancy and other writers here, but I think they're valid. I would also, if you want to bring it a little closer to home for Retronauts, compare him to Japanese writers and directors such as Hideo Kojima, Hayao Miyazaki, Yoshiyuki Tomino, in that I feel like, especially in The Hunt for Red October, there is the sense that war is bad. Human, like global nuclear conflict is something to be averted. That people who are involved in war and conflict and who die are humans and have interiority and are, you know, they're people just like us. And, you know, war is hell and really sucks. But at the same time, the engines with which we wage war are so cool. Oh my God, they're the best. So, you know, some of that humanitarian element kind of gets lost or rings hollow, as it does in something like Gundam or the later Metal Gear games or something like The Wind Rises by Miyazaki. A little bit of like the technical, wow, these machines are so cool. The mechanisms of war are so cool, kind of obliterates the human aspect and the sort of like, you know, This is Alan Alda in MASH feeling sad kind of mawkishness that they were going for. That tends to get a little bit scrambled. And that's definitely the case with Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, I would say I found a really good quote from Clancy in a 1986 interview. And he said, more than anything else, I'm a technology freak. And the best stuff is in the military. So I feel like he's a guy. I mean, let's not mince words here. You can see his picture behind me on Zoom here today. The man is a huge nerd.
Look carefully, Retronauts listeners.
The man was a huge nerd. He worked as an insurance salesman, you know, like, absolutely. And, like, he wrote this thing out of curiosity, out of just for fun. And he thought, you know, I think he said he thought he might sell a few thousand copies, whatever. And he wrote the story about people, but really it is almost as much about the stuff that they're using as the people themselves. And I feel like because it got so big, and especially because it was praised by the people in charge of our military machine at the time, I feel like you know, it's like the meme of, you know, the face staring at a media property. It's been going right over their head. It's like, I think millions of people watch this, read the book and watch the movie. And it's like, wow, war is cool. And it's like, well, is it though? You know, because when we get in the movie, we can see the characters on screen are very much unhappy with the situation they're occupying, especially Ramius, because Ramius is like, this submarine is gigantic and I hate it. I hate living in this thing. I hate that they built it. But he's,
it's not just that it's gigantic. It's that it is basically a weapon to surpass Metal Gear. It is, you know, the machine that will destabilize the sort of mutual assured destruction of the Cold War era, and would really upset the balance of power across the globe and lead to endless war and decimation and horrible things. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. And you have the scenes of the characters who are like, they first see pictures of submarine, like, what is this? Could it be this? Oh, that would be very, very bad. And you have the man who's actually inside the submarine is like, this sucks. We gotta steal this thing and get it the hell away from the people who built it, because this is just wrong. We can't do this. So you have sort of these clashing, like, the people are kind of, most of the people in the movie are kind of on the same page, but also you have, like, the machines for which they work, who are like, well, we need bigger submarines, we need more missiles, we need to, you know, we can't have a technology gap between us and the other side. Whereas the people, you know, who actually have to operate the machines are like, oh boy, we got another one.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a novel about cool technology, about speculative, almost science fiction, but in like the real grounded science fiction way, like the science behind a stealth submarine, kind of spun out into fiction in a sort of realistic, convincing sense of the word. And, you know, at the same time, it's very much rooted in real experiences of the Cold War. You know, the fact that potential nuclear global annihilation was averted a few times, such as during the Cuban Missile Crisis, by people who had a conscience and who said, you know what? I'm not willing to turn the key on this launch device until I'm 100% certain that this is actually the end. Like, there, you know, that we're not just wiping people out for no reason. And, you know, those people were punished initially, but history has vindicated them because, hey, they saved humanity more or less with, you know, just the conscience of one person or two people. And this is very much kind of built around that framework. And I feel like as you get further into Clancy's oeuvre and away from this novel, you kind of get away from that. And it becomes much more about like, Jack Ryan is such a cool badass. He should be president. Yes, that would be the best thing. And it just really gets away from the kind of underpinning of the Hunt for Red October, which is what would happen if, you know, one side created a weapon that could decimate the other side, just absolutely wipe them out before reprisals could happen. Like, that would be the worst thing in the world. And wouldn't it be great if, you know, there were someone who had the conscience to say, this is wrong, let's stop this. That kind of ultimate fantasy of, you know, humanity is its own worst enemy, but thankfully there are still some good eggs out there.
It's also telling that, you know, the movies that come after this that with Jack Ryan, at least the next two, are very much separated from the Cold War. They're very different conflicts, and they take on a very different tone. Of course, they're also played by, you know, with a very different actor in the lead, which we'll get to later, I'm sure.
No doubt. So, yeah, we've kind of talked about Tom Clancy a bit.
I guess we can conclude that Tom Clancy, like those Japanese creators you mentioned, is just another otaku.
Pretty much, yes. But, you know, with the military side of things, the American military side of things, as opposed to, like, we should bring back the Yamato and turn it into, like, a symbol for how cool we are now that we're bringing back the Japanese Imperial Navy, that kind of thing. But yeah. Kind of, you know, it's all kind of from the same place, that fascination with power and machines and instruments of death, without really necessarily stopping to say, oh, maybe I shouldn't glorify these. Because as, you know, Clancy's work evolved and his media empire grew, I feel like his work has really gotten away from that facet of things to where you get, you know, like Rainbow Six is pretty much just like, isn't it cool to be in a squad with people and shoot terrorists? And I'm not saying like, hey, don't ever play video games like that. Just like what I've seen of, you know, even Splinter Cell kind of, which is very narrative driven, very much focused around a central figure, a central character, really kind of gets away from that, that sort of basic humanity. Likewise, the Jack Ryan series on Amazon or Netflix or whatever it is. Like, it's about, you know, stopping conflicts and things like that, but not in a way that feels sincere and grounded in the way that Hunt for Red October does. And I guess that's the strength of Hunt for Red October, is that, like, you feel like these could be real people. I mean, it's cool that Jack Ryan is really smart and figures everything out, but it still feels like he could have arrived at his conclusions in a sort of organic way just by study. And they, you know, they call him in as an expert, so he did the job that he was hired to do. You kind of see Jack Ryan in the TV series, and it's he's kind of like a Superman. It's really weird. I feel like they had a great instinct by casting John Krasinski, casting, you know, Jim from The Office as Jack Ryan. That's what a great idea. And then they like have him turn into a Marvel superhero. He's like super buff and a perfect shot, and he's, you know, just killing dudes left and right and going on the run like Jason Bourne. And it doesn't quite feel like the same Jack Ryan who sat around, you know, for hours trying to convince a submarine captain, please don't kill the submarine because I think that this guy is on our side.
Yeah, book smart. Yeah,
the Jack Ryan in this story, and certainly other the other films as well, he is a gigantic nerd. Like, he is a huge, like, you know, the opening credits establish this. The camera slow pans around a library that is just chock full of, like, naval history and models and figurines. And like,
it was actually filmed in Tom Clancy's study.
Really? For real?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. it's very on brand, you know, like, and I'll be honest, I don't know where the rest of us fit here, but I mean, my dad was also a huge history buff. So I see a lot of Jack Ryan in my dad, and like, he read a lot. He knew a lot about history and conflicts. And he also wasn't a guy who was like, yeah, war is great. But he also like had this volume of material about, you know, for him, it was the Civil War, but like, he had a lot of stuff around the house. It was like, that's how I learned about this stuff, because it was him reading about it and say, hey, isn't this neat? Isn't this neat? Like, I guess so. But also, it kind of frightens me.
Yeah, my father is more of a, like, he's very scholarly, but it's much more focused on kind of early American history and also the evolution of, like, the church and theology, for the Protestant church. So those are kind of his areas of interest. So not a lot I can necessarily connect with. But my father-in-law is an extremely huge history nerd, but he's also very not enthusiastic about war, having lived through it as part of the South Vietnamese government during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And if you want to get him going sometime, just ask him about that fucking guy Kissinger, because he has some opinions. Based on firsthand experience, by the way. So, like, if someone's going to be able to give you the lowdown, it's going to be him.
That's our one F word for the podcast.
That is. It's still a PG-13. Actually, I think with Kissinger, it's a freebie.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, yeah, that's Clancy. So, you know, after this book became a massive seller and was eventually turned into a movie and into video games and so on and so forth, like I said, Clancy's work kind of continued to evolve. And I feel like it's sort of become one of the prime movers behind the current state of the American view on the military, which is like, hey, endless war is pretty cool. We don't actually need to declare war. We can just have actions, kind of like, you know, we were secretly doing in Nicaragua and whatever in the 80s, but now it's just out there right in the open. It's great. Let's do that because the military is fun and cool. Go fly a drone, kids. We'll pay for college.
Yeah, that's kind of a tricky thing, isn't it? Because it's like, okay, if Tom Clancy's just like a military nerd, he wasn't exactly a soldier or anything, but he writes these very involved novels and sort of ends up promoting this sort of military power and this sort of, you know, overreach of the state and things like that. Like, yeah, it becomes kind of a problem to wrestle with that just as an individual. I'm speaking for myself. Like, yeah, it's interesting stuff. It can be entertaining, but like it kind of also ended up possibly inadvertently kind of glorifying this stuff to a segment of the public that doesn't exactly know what's going on.
Oh, go ahead, fight.
I was just thinking about how many pop culture icons from the 80s involved wars, and then in turn, those movies and those books got the people at the top excited, and they right. heralded those things as awesome, and then it got down to the more people. Like, oh yeah, these things are awesome. You know, like Rambo. I mean, you look at First Blood, which is like an early 70s novel, becomes a movie in 82, and that is very much, you know, a story of a guy who went to war and he came back like, that was terrible. Like, why would we do that? But his story got all the wrong people excited. Like, yeah, he was a hero. We should have done more of that. And then all of a sudden the sequel of Rambo is like, you know what? I'm going back to Vietnam and I'm going to win the war myself, goddammit.
Yeah,
and
then, finally something we can make a video game out of.
Right. And then by the end of the 80s, Rambo's, you know, fighting Afghanistan with the brave Mujahideen fighters, and it's just like, "Oh my goodness, what's happened? Where did we go? How did we get here?"
Those cool guys in the Taliban.
Yeah. Dedicated to them basically at the end of the film.
Yeah, it is. It's great. Yeah, it's really tricky, and I, you know, obviously, Clancy's not the only one who was doing that. But look at Top Gun or something along those lines. I don't want to turn this into
all that stuff.
I don't know. It's an election year, so why don't we just get political? It's fine. No one cares. Everyone loves it.
I mean, it's all connected. It's all part of the same web. It's all part of the same web. It's like, you know, one hand feeding the other at this point.
As soon as we elected an actor, it was just as president. It was all over. But no, the thing about The Hunt for Red October is it was published in 1984. And as you point out in the notes, Fight, that was still kind of an era of maybe like the sort of the end of the really tense years between the U.S. and the West and the Soviet Union. But as the prologue, the prelude to the movie and all the video games based on Hunt for Red October note, this was just a few months before Gorbachev came to power. Took over as premier of the Soviet Union. And he was really instrumental in ushering in, you know, in de-escalating the tensions between the West and the Soviet Union and helping to normalize things and build relations. So, you know, it comes out at a time of great tension, but the thing that I think is really admirable about The Hunt for Red October is that it presents both the American and the Soviet characters involved as humans. Like I said earlier, they have interiority. That you know, in the hands of John McTiernan, that becomes a little corny. Like, I'm Sam Neill and I want to eat a Big Mac in Montana. You know, it's a little corny, but it shows, like, you know, most of the Russian sailors are conscripts and they have anxiety about being in the submarine. They're not necessarily doing it because of patriotism. They're doing it because it's their requirement under the law. So if they don't want to end up in a gulag somewhere or just in jail, then they need to go, you know, serve their time in the Navy. And it really, in a way that other media at the time did not, presents Russians and really everyone from the Soviet Union, like Captain Ramius is Lithuanian. So you have, you know, just this melange of different nationalities, Ukrainians and so forth, under the Soviet banner. It presents them as being, you know, not so different from us. And that is a crucial understanding to come to if you want to start to sympathize with the other guys. When you stop thinking of them as the other and more like just a different version of us born under different circumstances, I think that does a lot, maybe more than anything else, to foment the idea of peace and good relationships, because, you know, you just need that most people need that element of sympathy and understanding and relatability. And this book, you know, for whatever it might have set into motion, I feel like The Hunt for Red October does a pretty good job of that. And, you know, the movie does too. And I don't think you get as much of that in something like Patriot Games, where, you know, you have IRA terrorists, and they're not really presented in the most sympathetic light. They're pretty bloodthirsty and murderous. And yes, they have grievances that go back a long time, and they're legitimate grievances. But it's really hard to relate to the IRA, like the leadership, especially, you know, the main character who's just out to get Jack Ryan, in a way that, like, it's just not like that kind of compassion doesn't transfer over. Same with, you know, Clear and Present Danger. I don't think you really get a great sense of, like, oh yes, these guys in the drug cartels, they are not so different from you and I. And, you know, maybe that's fair enough, but I feel like that is something that really sets The Hunt for Red October apart, not only from Clancy's work, but also just from, like, U.S. Soviet fiction at the time, is just the willingness to say, oh yeah, actually, these are, you know, these are normal people.
There's very few villains in this story, and even the ones who are, like, outright, like, dastardly. Like, I would say the closest thing this movie has to a villain is probably Stellan Skarsgård as the, I probably mangled his name, but, you know, he's the other sub-captain of the Tupolev, and he doesn't have a lot of scenes, so he's basically there to be, like, a snarling meanie. But even then, you can see there's some humanity. Like, someone's asked, like, hey, Captain, what are we doing? He's like, we're off to kill a friend. We have to kill Ramius. You know, and, like, he seems to take some pleasure in that later in the movie, but, like, he's still, like, he's got something there. There's something there behind it. It's like, I've got this order. I've got to do this. So, God damn it, I'm going to do it. But, you know, he acknowledges that this guy used to be his friend. Mm-hmm. And other people, like, way up the top, you know, you got Joss Ackland, who basically made a career in the 80s and 90s just playing, like, you know, dastardly villain types. You know, like, he was the evil South African ambassador in Lethal Weapon 2. You know, you've got him in this movie, you know, playing the Russian ambassador, and he's clearly a guy who's like, hey, man, I do what they tell me, you know. Apparently, we lost a submarine. You know what? You know what? The submarine's actually running away, and it's just...
there's a lot of flop sweat involved. He's getting flop sweat.
Yeah, he's clearly uncomfortable with his role, and he's doing his best, and he's like, I just, you know... He says it, like, I only have the information they give me, you know?
Yeah, so kind of with that in mind, I do feel like this ended up being good propaganda, not just for, you know, the cool American military machine, but also for the idea of giving peace a chance and, you know, letting the wall come down and the Soviets be our pals. And, you know, it's the timing of the movie. It landed just after the Berlin Wall had come down.
Yeah,
and
within months.
You know, there was a lot of turmoil happening politically on the other side of the so-called Iron Curtain. And within a couple of years, we had, you know, the sort of dissolution of the Soviet Union and, you know, Gorbachev and Yeltsin and all that, the coup and the revolution and yada, yada, yada. It was a pretty painful process, and we're still feeling the aftershocks of everything that happened, not necessarily for the better. But like the timing on this, I think, really did kind of help. I think, you know, with the general American sentiment, this was a very popular movie, very well loved. You know, the actors who figured heavily in it were kind of in their prime and peak popularity. And it, you know, just a really well put together piece of popcorn cinema that made people stop and say, oh, yeah, I like that Montana guy. He was neat.
Yeah.
Whomst among us doesn't want to go have a beautiful wife in Montana? So anyway, that is the novel. Let's talk about the movie and actually talk about the plot of the movie and the events of the movie, because we have a tendency to go into these media-focused episodes and forget to actually explain the events. And sure, it just takes a couple of hours to go watch this movie. But, you know, sometimes it's nice just to have everything sort of explained to you so we're not just speaking around things. So The Hunt for Red October, the movie, came out in 1990, summer popcorn flick, starring Alec Baldwin as the main character, Jack Ryan. And this was the first time I'd really heard of Alec Baldwin. Apparently, he had been in stuff before this, much to my surprise.
This is like his first big lead, yeah.
Yeah, it's like he had a quick rise in the 80s. He did, I looked it up, like he had five movies come out in 1988, which is kind of shocking when that happens. But I think a lot of people who listen to Retronauts, I think probably saw Beetlejuice. And, you know, he's got a major role in that, even though I guess Michael Keaton is arguably the star of Beetlejuice because he is Beetlejuice. But like screen time wise, like Alec Baldwin is way more a character in that movie than, you know, Beetlejuice is. Beetlejuice shows up.
True.
But yeah, I would say this movie definitely elevated Baldwin to sort of leading man status. And I would also argue that he's never in another big movie, like, and he's never in a movie this big again as a lead. Like he doesn't work for him. And probably part of that is the fact that he doesn't get to be Jack Ryan again, because they immediately replace him with an even bigger star in the sequels.
Well, I mean, he kind of did that to himself. He wanted a massive payday for the next movie. And they said, if we're going to give you that much, we can just go and hire Harrison Ford. And that's exactly what they did. So I think he kind of overshot the mark a little bit, and it worked out poorly for him.
Yeah, there's stories that, you know, they went to Kevin Costner and they went to Harrison Ford first, who both said no for this film. And I think, once this movie came a hit, I think they realized, oh, wait, we wanted Harrison Ford in the first place. We should just get Harrison Ford back. But yeah, it's certainly, I think for what's happening here on screen, I think Alec Baldwin is a really good choice because he is sort of this guy. Mm-hmm. He's this guy who's very, you know, he knows his stuff, but he's also kind of like, there's lots of situations where they're like, okay, Jack, let's do this now. We're having a briefing. You're leading it. And there's a great thing where he sort of freezes. Like, he's like, I'm doing what now? You know, like, it's like, you know, Ramis is like, okay, we're in a competition here. You sit here, drive the sub. He's like, I'm not a naval officer. I write books. I'm an author, you know? And it's like this, a lot of great stuff like that, where you really feel this guy who's like, he's sort of excited to be here because like he's living among these guys who he thinks is our heroes, and he reads about submarines all the time, so it's kind of neat to him to be there, but also like, holy shit, people are shooting at me, I almost died getting on the submarine, what's going on, can I please go home now?
Yeah, I mean, The Hunt for Red October is kind of a self-insert fic for Tom Clancy.
Oh, yeah.
He's basically like, hey, what if I were kind of handsome and cool, but not too cool, just cool enough to, you know, save the world.
Yeah.
No big guy. No big deal, guys.
I mean, it's funny that they also got Harrison Ford, because it's like, book smart guy who gets into like action-y scraps is also Indiana Jones.
So. Right. But I feel like Alec Baldwin is a more convincing Jack Ryan to me. And it's not just because I see Harrison Harrison Ford. It's because it's more believable that he would kind of be shut down the way he is sometimes. he is
he's also younger.
He's younger. That helps. But also he just doesn't have the presence of Harrison Ford.
Right.
Like you don't just, you know, tell Harrison Ford to sit down and shut up. And there is like this kind of military hierarchy in place. And Jack Ryan isn't even an officer or enlisted. So he's kind of outside the command, which means basically when he's in the sub, even though he's a consultant, he basically needs to, you know, hop to it whenever they tell him to and shut up and get out of the way when he's not needed. And I feel like it's harder to kind of push Harrison Ford around that way, the way that they do to Alec Baldwin in this movie. And so to me, like, it just works better for the character. And I feel like, you know, bringing Harrison Ford in is kind of the beginning of the march to muscle man John Krasinski as Jack Ryan.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
One of the things I think, I mean, one of the many strengths of this film, I believe, is that it really gives you, certainly as to a casual viewer like me who has never set foot in a base or anything, I feel like it really does a great job of depicting what a chain of command looks like. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many situations, both in the U.S. and you see on the submarine as well, of just like, here's the person in charge, here's the people who work for the guy in charge, and here's the rest of us. And you see a lot of the back and forth, and you see a lot of, you know, decorum and how you should act. You know, there's a lot of great scenes with Sam Neill and Sean Connery on the submarine where Sam Neill is like, he's the first officer, so he's got to be there for the captain. Like, he's got to, like, the captain gives the order, I'm the captain, we follow the captain's orders. And like, as soon as he closed the door, Sam Neill's like, sir, you know, I would never say this outside of this room, but what are you doing, man? What are you doing? This is, no, we can't, you shouldn't have done that. Only in private.
Yeah, I think the actor who plays Dallas, who was that?
Is it the captain of Dallas? That was Scott Glenn.
Right, right. No, okay, yes, it's my fault because I'm always, I always get this conflated with Alien, where the captain's name is Dallas. that's my problem. I saw these movies for the first time around the same time, so.
Yeah, it's Tom Skerritt, my guy.
Anyway, yeah, I think Dallas, not Dallas, Captain Mancuso, yes, the captain of the Dallas. He clearly has a lot of latitude in the actions he takes, but ultimately he does have, you know, higher authorities to answer to. So he's you know, kind of willing to entertain Ryan's theories and thoughts and requests, but only to a point. And, you know, at some point he's like, we've got to, you know, kind of draw a line right here. So this is how long you have to make your crazy cockamamie ideas work.
Right. And when they actually had the pivotal scene where they all get in the mini sub and they're going over to visit the Red October, you know, after an entire film of sort of back and forth, you know, we in the audience have seen these characters on both sides, but the people on board the submarine are actually going to visit the Red October for the first time. Like, they don't know what's going to happen. So he's there in the mini sub, he's got his gun, and he hands a gun to Jack Ryan. Jack Ryan's like, I don't need a gun. And he's like, are you willing to bet your life on that? And eventually he's like, yeah, okay, I'll take the gun. And then you have that great scene where they're all sort of staring each other down inside on the bridge of the Red October. And Sean Connery just looks at him and the camera pans down and you see Scott Glenn with a gun on his side. And Sean Connery's like, oh, he's a goddamn buckaroo. Like, oh, what's this guy? What's this guy with a gun on my boat? And it just says this funny little, you know, confrontation where everyone's like, how do we read this guy? What's his deal? What's my deal? You know, are we safe? And in the end, the gun ends up being a big deal because there is, in fact, a danger on the Red October. But so it does. It was the right call.
Right. That Chekhov's gun in action again. Or really kind of the John McTiernan Tiernan gun. The director of The Hunt for Red October was John McTiernan, who yes. was at the peak of his power right here. He had just come off a string of very, very successful movies that have become, you know, iconic all-timers. You know, he made a movie or two that no one really remembers, but then he directed Schwarzenegger in Predator, which is like, it's such a, you know, along with Aliens, I can't believe we haven't done a Predator episode yet. It's such a template for the modern action movie. Just quippy, concise, clever, very steroidal. It's kind of everything you want an action movie to be. And Die Hard, you know, kind of does the same thing, but with more of a something of an everyman. You know, Bruce Willis is much more, human looking than Schwarzenegger in his, you know, Mr. Universe prime. So, you know, you have basically an adaptation of the novel working in the same mode as those movies, which is to say that they're just lean, efficient, and extremely punchy. Like the dialogue in McTiernan movies is always great, and no detail is wasted. Anything that's mentioned in like the first 15 minutes of the movie is going to play a crucial part somewhere down the line. I mean, Die Hard is kind of the poster child for that, but it's really the case for everything. Like, you know, in Predator, the way the Predator kills each of the squad members in a way that kind of satirizes or like lampoons or inverts their personal fears and phobias that they open up about. Like, you know, they all talk about their various feelings and conflicts and things like that. And then there's some sort of twisted way that relates to those things and how they die. So this is, you know, it's very much like the blockbuster machine approach, but it was still fresh and, you know, I think built on the foundation of a really solid, entertaining work to begin with in this case. And it just works. It's a really, just an excellent popcorn movie. And it doesn't hurt that, you know, in addition to Alec Baldwin, you also have Sean Connery playing Marco Ramius, the defector, like really the central figure in this movie. He's not the main character in the sense that Jack Ryan is. You don't see things necessarily as much from his point of view and him trying to decrypt things, but I guess he's a deuteragonist. Is that how you pronounce that? Yes. You have the protagonist, but if there's two of them, it's the deuteragonist. Because I've only read that word and never heard it aloud, I might have said it the wrong way.
Oh, we're all in the same boat there. Hey, get it, boat?
Hey!
Yeah, I mean, this is not like Das Boot in the sense that this is an easy watch. Like,
exactly.
And it doesn't like overstay its welcome. It doesn't go too over the top or anything. So like if you expect some sort of, you know, a too technical military movie about submarine battles and whatnot, like, it's not that. It's an easy watch overall.
Yeah. Yeah. And even though there is an epilogue, like not an epilogue, but sort of a post climax coda, almost not it's not a denouement, but there's like, you know, it seems like everything is resolved, but then there's one last bit to deal with, you know, kind of like in Die Hard, how you have you know, the guy in the meat hook comes back to life and tries to kill them and they have to stop him at the last second. it's kind of the same way, but even that is like very kind of quick and efficient. It's maybe 5 minutes of the movie dealing with the, you know, the spy, the assassin at the end. It, you know, compare that to like Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, where you have basically the entire thing with Two-Face at the end is just like, it's like half an hour longer than the movie needs to be. Like, hey, why don't you save that for the next movie? You know, McTiernan doesn't do that. He was very much about like, oh, here's the surprise, but yeah, it's okay. It's not going to be dragged out.
You know, Jeremy, when you lay out those three films in a row, something struck me, you know, from Predator to Die Hard to Hunt for Red October, you have a steady sort of, say weakening, but sort of like normalization of the hero. Like, you know, you've got this giant man, mountain of a man, Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator. Then you have Bruce Willis, who's very much a regular guy, but he's also a cop. So, you know,
very fit, yeah.
Right. He spends the entire movie like shooting people in the face. It doesn't bother him at all. And then you have Alec Baldwin here, who's very much a book nerd, who's like, you know, he has a military background, which they outline in the movie, but like, he's very much not used to any of this. And at the same time, you've got sort of escalating stakes. Like, Predator is all about a single conflict in the jungle that only really affects them. Die Hard, you've got a, you know, potential disaster in a building that could affect lots of people, but it is very much one building. Whereas Hunt for October, you basically have the stakes are nuclear war and global annihilation. So like, as things get bigger, the hero gets smaller. And I think that's a very interesting contrast. Maybe just,
well, I think Also, the character opposite the hero, his not necessarily antagonist, but counterpart, becomes more and more developed and more relatable. You know, the Predator, there's clearly a lot going on with the Predator, but aside from the little recorded sampled voice bits that he picks up from the characters in the jungle, he doesn't really speak. And right. he uses like simple gestures to communicate. So you're kind of left like wondering, what was this guy all about? You know, in Die Hard, you have Alec Rickman, and he says he wants one thing, but actually he wants something much more banal than that. And so he has understandable motives, but you're like, he's not really a good guy. And then you get to Captain Ramius, who is unknowable from, you know, the other character, like the American's perspective, and even from his own crew's perspective. He's very closed and contained, but he does, you know, have the people he can confide in, and you come to see like he's motivated not only by his reluctance to be part of basically the destabilization of the entire planet, but also his very personal hurt from the way he was treated when his wife was killed, when his wife died, and, you know, the resentment that he carries toward the sort of Soviet political system that resulted in all of that. And he felt, you know, didn't resolve things the way he felt it should be. So, you know, the antagonists, or it's hard to call Ramius a villain, but the character on the other side grows more and more relatable and more human. So yeah, there is this kind of interesting delta of factors that kind of evolves through this McTiernan trilogy.
Now, as we said earlier, I didn't read the book, but I know that the movie, I think, gives Ramius a lot more things, like speeches. I was read about, they had filmmaker John Milius come in to like write more speeches for Sean Connery. So I wonder how that changes his characterization from the movie to the book. I don't remember. Again, I didn't read the book, but
It's been a long time since I've read the book. I don't remember him really being that much of a character, but you know, 35 years is a long time. So what do I know?
Because I think a lot about the speech. Like, there's a really good speech he gives. I'm pretty sure it's in private. I think it's just him and Sam Neill sort of chatting. And Sean Connery, you know, talks about the Cold War, and he's like, a war with no battles, no monuments, only casualties. It's like, we've been out here, you know, he's spent his entire life, you know, commanding submarines on this Navy, and he hasn't, you know, he can't fight anybody, because if he fights anyone, you know, it's all going to end. But he still has to be out here and doing all this stuff. And while he's out there, he said, like, while I was at sea, like, my wife died, you know, he's crushed by that.
So that's the good stuff about John McTiernan. The bad stuff is basically everything that happened after this. He, I don't know. He made some interesting-ish movies in the 90s. I don't think they were as timeless as his 80s movies. Like Die Hard with a Vengeance is better than Die Hard 2. What was it called? Die Harder? Yes. Okay. Like Die Harder, not great. Die Hard with a Vengeance has some issues, feels kind of like a watered down echo of the original movie, but it's still better than the second movie and better than anything that came after. That's for sure. The Thomas Crown Affair remake starring Pierce Brosnan, who he helped kind of turn into a star in the first place with his first movie. Yep. I think is actually a pretty fun movie.
I love
my
it.
My wife is a big fan of it, and we've watched it a few times together, and yeah, it's very enjoyable. And then the most interesting of these movies is The Last Action Hero, which is actually McTiernan satirizing his own work. It's a really strange movie. Like at the time I thought it was, I enjoyed it. Even though a lot of people I saw it with, I went to see it with a group of school friends. They were all kind of like, this was stupid. I was like, no, this was actually really interesting, because it was just totally like lampooning all these, you know, big schlocky action movies that we've been seeing in theaters. So I was kind of into it. But looking back, I realized, oh, McTiernan was actually making fun of his own work. And that's a pretty bold move, in my opinion. It's basically doing a piss take on your own, you know, your own legacy.
I think it's a movie that has a very different reputation now than it did when it came out. I think when it came out, everyone sort of, you know, it definitely made money, but also it didn't make the amount of money they thought it would. It opened, like, I think a week before Jurassic Park, which then just ate its lunch. So everyone sort of reacted to it like, oh no, Schwarzenegger's not as popular anymore. But it's like, okay, but he was trying to do something different, and I feel like that's worth noting. And I think the movie, I think, probably has a lot more defenders today than it did in 1993. But yeah, I would say if we talk about the, you know, the Predator, Die Hard, Red October sort of trilogy, you look at John McTiernan's work in the 90s, and it's very up and down, very spotty. I mean, the decade ends with sort of the two-punch of Thomas Crown Affair, which is a very, it's kind of a quiet movie, even though it does have some over-the-top elements. But you also have The 13th Warrior, which is a movie that I think he made, he probably shot like years earlier, and it spent a long time in post-production. They renamed it, they cut it to hell and back, and so it kind of just, it bombed. It lost a lot of money. And then the 21st century arrives, and John McTiernan like makes two movies in a row that everyone hates. Everyone hates these movies. I've never seen Rollerball, but I've heard nothing but terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
I did see Basic, and I tell you, Basic sucks. But then you also have this trial where he gets in a lot of trouble for like wiretapping people, hiring someone to spy on someone, spy on his wife during a divorce. Like, he goes to jail, basically kills his career, and you know, he's still alive. He's still out there giving interviews and occasionally saying interesting things, if I may, but he's definitely not making movies anymore, and people don't want to work with him anymore. But it's kind of like, what happened? Like, he had it all, and then it changed, and then it completely burned and crashed. And it's sort of a really bizarre career, I think, from anyone who didn't just die because of an accident or something. Like, it is a really bizarre career.
Yeah, I've seen comments by people who knew him and said basically, he was a man who didn't believe that the law and that the rules applied to him. And that's how you end up with him. Basically, you know, after he directed Schwarzenegger in The Last Action Hero, it's like he saw Schwarzenegger in True Lies and was like, yes, I should treat my wife that way also. I think that's good and healthy in the real world, as opposed to in a schlocky action movie. So, Not a great note for his career to end on. And it's a real bummer because, you know, once I sat down and started to realize a few years back, like, oh, all these really great, like super lean, really memorable, iconic movies were John McTiernan. I wonder what he's up to. I sat down and read what he's up to and said, oh, well, okay. Sometimes it's better off not knowing.
Hey guys, I don't have a whole lot more time here, so I was hoping we could move faster to talking about the games, because that's kind of what I'm better prepared for.
Okay, so we're not going to describe the plot of Hunt for Red October after all, and that's okay. We should talk about the video games, because that is the core of this podcast.
That's what it's
really about. It's a video games podcast. So really, I feel like there are three kind of top-level Hunt for Red October games. There is the game that came out before the movie, and then two different games adapted to different platforms that came out after the movie. And someone I see was getting cheeky and added game 1.5. Do we talk about board games on this podcast? It's a video game podcast. How dare you?
It's not called Paper Knots. Get out of here.
That's right. Have we ever talked about Trivial Pursuit? Absolutely no.
Well, anyway. I will someday, Retronauts, because I love Trivial Pursuit. Are you kidding
me? Trivial Pursuit, really cool. I like being a know-it-all, and that's an opportunity to do that. So anyway, the first game on the list is one I have not played because it is a European computer game published in 1987, so 3 years before the film, by Oxford Digital Enterprises. Diamond, you put a note on here about them having created a skeleton game with Spider-Man. What the hell? I don't know anything about this.
In looking up and look up the credits for this game, I had to check like who made all these games. And for most of the cases, the people who made these games are just like contract studios. They made a lot of licensed stuff, but it struck me that Oxford Digital Enterprises also made The Amazing Spider-Man for a variety of PC platforms, and that's the game that has a giant portrait of Spider-Man on the screen, and as you take damage, Spider-Man slowly turns into a skeleton.
One. Okay, yes, right. The health meter, yes. Okay, yeah. I remember that now. Horrible. Anyway, Ray, have you played this Hunt for Red October game?
I tried.
Okay.
Well, I most certainly tried.
That's something.
I think what we're going to characterize here is sort of common with a lot of computer games based on like other media franchises. So like this game is a lot more technical than the console games we're also going to talk about. Mm-hmm. I'm also reminded of the Shogun computer game, because Shogun's also popular now because there's a new TV show and everything. But
yeah, like, getting back to Clavel.
Yeah, that's also like a somewhat inscrutable adventure game. And this in the same way is kind of like trying to translate a bunch of submarine commanding type of instructions into a computer game. And at being a computer game, usually a bit more adult skewed than some other things. And, you know, it just kind of gets a bit like, you got to read the manual is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this watching videos of this, it really strikes me as one, kind of the exactly what you would expect from a 1987 computer sim, which is complex, a very difficult interface that has a lot of options and tries to do a lot in terms of like a real simulation, and really like is a game that's become so abstract through its complexity that you really just need to sit down with the manual open at all times to have the first hint of what you're supposed to do and how you go about doing it. I mean, there are so many options for, you know, do you want to move? Do you want to use your weapon? Oh, okay, you want to use a weapon. Which weapon do you want to use? How do you want to deploy? Do you want to deploy, like, you know, a life raft or something? Or how are you going to target your missiles, your torpedoes? It's very dense. It looks just very, very difficult. But it's also kind of the platonic ideal of what I would want a Red October game to be. Because ultimately, like, how do you translate the story of Red October into a video game? I feel like, you know, the part that is most video game friendly is the stealth submarine element, you know, trying to sneak around beneath the ocean with the limitations. I mean, one thing the movie does that I think is brilliant is really drive home how difficult and how dangerous, you know, captaining and piloting a submarine is underwater, moving, you know, blindly through a trench in this gigantic metal tube that you can't just stop on a dime, that you have to avoid, you know, creating any kind of noise whatsoever that's not natural, you know, that's not, you know, something that can be mistaken for background water, you know, underwater noises. Like that has the potential to be a very immersive and compelling video game, but I don't know that the computer technology of 1987 was necessarily the venue to do that with. I think it probably would have worked a lot better like a decade later, where there was just, you know, much more room and memory and, you know, resolution available to kind of make these things friendly and accessible to the player without them having to reference a manual the entire time.
Yeah. I would argue maybe even like a few years later when we had like Windows 3.1 and things, because like on that evolution of graphic user interfaces, I think you saw a lot more simulation focused games that, you know, just weren't booting a DOS. It was stuff that was using like the Windows UI structure to create this sort of like control panel for these simulation games. And I think this would have been a better fit for that because it is entirely menu driven. There's like almost nothing where you are directly controlling or fighting in the sub necessarily. There's some things that are like it, but for the most part, most of what you do is like UI driven commands. And That's kind of clever. I mean, I'm not going to hate on the game too much or anything. I don't think it's bad. It's just an interesting approach because it's like, it's probably more like what Tom Clancy himself might have liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. That's the target audience for this. Like they wanted to make a game for the millions of people who bought that book and thought, I wonder if I could pilot a submarine. Well, here's your chance to find out. It's all about bearings and headings and, you know, your depth settings and, you know, do you want to raise a periscope? Okay, raise a periscope. Oh, you got spotted, you know?
Yep.
So anyway, in 1988, there was a physical board game by TSR, which apparently was a big seller. Do you want to give us a quick rundown?
I just want to make the note that there was a board game. So like there were versions of Hunt for October that people were playing and enjoying before the movie came out. And then the movie sort of took over. It's like, okay, now we need to make our games just like this movie that made $200 million. So we need to make the game that looks like the movie. Or later on, make a game that doesn't look like the movie at all, but it has Sean Connery on the cover. So, you know, good for us.
Right.
It's a really strange route. That's what I'm saying. It's a very strange route that this property has taken. That's what I'm trying to get at.
So let's move ahead to 1990 and the movie tie-in, the game of the movie of the book. So there were two different takes on this. One was console and one was computer. So Ray, dealer's choice, which do you want to talk about first?
Oh, gosh. I figured we'd just go chronological in a sense.
Okay. I mean, they're all 1990, so...
Well, the Ish. SNES I mean, one the, was the last, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was kind of grouping that with the NES, right. Game Boy, yeah. And Super NES, because they're all
kind
of the same, just, you know, different interpretations of that concept.
You're right. So, I can start with talking about the Commodore versions, essentially, the Amiga and C64 games. And, I think my overall view of those games was that there is a sort of trend with European developed computer games based on movies. I know it's very specific, but stay with me, in that they are all like four or five levels. And two of those levels are like the super long, super tough ones. And they're just kind of like bookended by these very short action scenes. I feel like there's a ton of games like that, not just Red October, but this is definitely in that wheelhouse of just like very, very short, very sort of quickly made, just like get in, get out, and not very play tested. Just sort of like games made to make a buck. And whether that's too cynical of you, I don't know. There are some good ideas in this version of the game that I think the later Nintendo versions don't try. For example, the first level of this game where you are skipping basically to the middle of the movie, I think, where Jack Ryan tries to land on the Dallas. From the helicopter, like that's a good idea for a level of a video game. I don't know why it's the first level in this game. I also don't know why it's so insanely hard, but if you do manage to get past it, you will then move on to what basically the rest of these games are like, which is a side-scrolling shooter essentially. But yeah, I just think it's this whole game is very typical of like those kind of specific movie games where it's just like a few levels, get in, get out, thanks for your money.
I will say that my brother worked for a few years as a helicopter pilot based on an aircraft carrier, and his descriptions of the process of just doing anything that involves landing or, you know, fine maneuvers at sea, I feel like that level has to be like insanely hard, because I just can't even imagine doing the kinds of things and having the, like, the nerve to actually say, yes, I'm going to take this on and complete this that, that he's described it as. So, you know what? I'm going to say it's a fair cop.
Okay. Yeah. I suppose it's accurate. Yeah.
I also think it's very interesting how that all these different versions of this game, not the other games, this particular game, the opening level is the one that varies the most from platform to platform, because some of them are side view, some of them involve a lot of, you know, technical stuff, like whether or not the line is a single, you know, straight line, or does it move it back and forth. And then you have the Amiga version, which is literally like a top-down, like, sprite scaling view of, like, you get closer and closer to submarines, so it gets bigger and bigger in your view. Like, this is the one level that changes the most from version to version. Mm. And I find that very interesting, like, as an overview of, like, computer platforms in 1990. Because what can you do with this one mechanic? You can do a lot of things, actually.
So it's kind of like how some of the Jurassic Park games would just randomly throw you into a first-person shooting sequence, but not all of them. So it was kind of a, you know, potluck. Do I get to play as a Velociraptor, or do I have to do FPS?
Yeah. I will say, though, the Amiga version is probably the best looking.
Oh, yeah.
That is also, you know, an unexpected thing, I think, of a lot of Amiga games, where you get the best artists to make the best possible art, and you get that here. A lot of, you know, pillow shading and whatnot.
So I'm curious about the fifth and final stage in this one, the shooting gallery in the missile room. How does that work exactly? Is there like, are you basically surrounded by red barrels that will explode if you shoot them?
I don't even think it's that bad. It's sort of like the shooting series in Snatcher. You just kind of like move the cursor to predetermined spaces and try and get the guy when he pops out.
Yeah, like every version has its own sort of take on the scene, but basically you're in the missile room, so you get these giant missiles all around, and Ryan is sort of in the front of the screen, and the one guy sort of pops up in different locations around the screen, and you just have to aim the cursor and shoot him faster than he shoots you. So, like, you're not actually moving the character, it's just cursor-based, but it's like,
it's like, goddamn cook!
All right. See, there are still references to go around. I didn't burn through all of them at the beginning.
I know. I was warning you before. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. 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 I mean, I did back off, so that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you have anything more to say about the PC games, or do you just want to?
I started with the DOS version of this. So the DOS one's kind of an extension of the Commodore ones, and it's not as good. It's like, it's...
I feel that like that was usually the case.
Yeah, if for some reason, like, well, I think another typical thing of all these sorts of games is that they're made maybe from one design document, let's say, and then there are different groups of people running off and doing their own version of that. Mm-hmm. And so DOS version kind of hews a bit closest to the Amiga version. But for some reason, like, once you get to level two, like the side-scrolling shooting, it just seems like the canyons, the landscape is even tighter spaced, and it's a lot harder to get through. It's like if we presume that the Amiga version was maybe not as playtested, like, I can tell that this one was really not playtested and just like completely hammered away by the pro programmers and who knew the game inside and out. This feels this like version, one of those times.
Was this version published by High Tech Expressions?
Yes, it was.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was actually making a joke. Okay. Well, that explains everything.
Was it? Oh, okay. Hold on. Wait. No, hold on. Let me confirm on that. I might have just been thinking of Nintendo just then, but okay. Maybe not.
Oh. Shoot.
All right.
Dang. I was almost awesome. Oh, well.
Close. Very close.
Oh, yeah. DOS is software tool works. So, no. Yeah.
Right. Oh, well. The spirit of High Tech Expressions lives on, though.
Sorry to lead you on the hunt for crap.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But let's talk about the console versions, because those are the ones I'm familiar with, and I don't feel like any of them are good, but maybe I'm wrong?
I slightly disagree.
Okay.
Let's just start where it starts with the NES one,
sure.
Which is This and the Game Boy one were made by Beam Software. And a lot of Beam's games are fairly all right. I don't have a lot of problems with most of them. But this is basically just, like I insinuated before, these are all basically side-scrolling shooters that where you play a submarine and you move around like a submarine, and that's cool. That's different than, you know, whatever other spaceship stuff is out there as far as shooters go. But yeah.
The basis for In the Hunt.
Yeah. And I forget what the actual mission of the first level of the NES version is, but...
It just drops you straight into the action. There's no preamble aside from the intro. It's just like you're in a sub, and within like 3 seconds, you're being targeted by a barrage of homing torpedoes. Okay. Like this game has no mercy whatsoever. I will say that the explosions look incredible.
The explosions, like, yes.
Top tier NES explosions, and that's good because you see them so often.
And I made a game with a lot of explosions. These are really, really good looking explosions. Better than that one for sure. So yeah. But when you, you were thrown into this first level and it has like this brick wall background that I swear to God looked like glitched graphics at first. Mm. Like it was so not what I was expecting. Like I had to check my emulator. I had to check a second emulator. I had to make sure not that it wasn't, you know, some other hardware thing. I was going to call Nintendo World Class Service to have it looked at. But no, it's just like, this purple brick melange that looks like glitchy graphics until you finally get ahead of it and then into the water and the rest of the game looks normal. I was just like, make that choice? Interesting.
I guess those are like supposed to be the shipyards that you start out in.
Yeah.
And there's like these giant gates that come out at you on a pattern.
Yeah.
And all the guns in the shipyard are pointed inward, which I feel like that speaks to a very low level of trust in their own people. I feel like, you know, the biggest problem that the Soviet Union faced was just an inability to trust other Soviets. If only they had been more open and pointed the guns outward, you know, they might still be around today.
Yeah. I'll say also, though, probably the smartest thing this game does is have a little radar minimap on the bottom of the screen, because you are going to be going up and down and all around in the sea, of course, and you will probably be seeing projectiles from enemies where you can't see the enemies. So you're just seeing the projectiles. And so it helps to have this little mini map to see where the guys are above or below you and try and maneuver that way. And so, I like it, because otherwise I think this game would have been a lot harder and a lot worse for that if it didn't have that. And so it's kind of cute.
It's already really, really hard.
Right. Yeah. Don't get me wrong there. It's still very hard and a little bit bad, but geez, just imagine if they didn't have the minimap.
I will say that, you know, having a minimap, like, it's sonar, and the whole point of the Red October was that they had to keep their sonar off so that they couldn't be seen. Yeah. So already, level one, and already you're stumbling across accuracy issues. Very, very problematic.
Well, again, imagine if it was so accurate. Then we wouldn't even bother doing this episode. We would just have nothing else good to say about this game. Yeah.
Can I say the music sucks? Can I just say that? The music's terrible.
Yeah, that's not a surprise, really, I would say.
Tim
Fallon got brought on or anything.
No, I
didn't love the music, and that actually is kind of a surprise, because I usually think Beam Software, you know, it may not be fun, but it's going to have some big juicy fonts, and the soundtrack is going to rip. And it didn't deliver on either of those fronts. The font is just a normal little font. Like, anyone could have done that font. It didn't look like a Beam font.
Oh, yeah.
All these games have their own unique features, and they all sound very different. But the NES version in particular, the music is just like this droning background sound that's like a short loop, and it's really bad. Like, obnoxiously bad.
Yeah.
Someone was like, I like Zevius. I should do that. But then they did it poorly.
But I do think it's funny that of all these versions, the NES, Game Boy, and SNES, this is the only one that gives you a platforming section as Sean Connery. That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did fall through with that.
And I also think it's very funny that, you know, first of all, instead of just one-on-one combat, it's now, like, there's an army of saboteurs on board the Red October, and there's bombs everywhere. So you have to, like, run and jump and, like, defuse all the bombs. And also, to me, again, I'm not a filthy person, but to me, seeing Sean Connery stand in front of the bomb and then turn and face away from the camera for several seconds, it looks like he's just pissing on the bomb to defuse it. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you put out the fuse.
They don't make movie games like they used to, you know?
Or at all, really. Okay, so I feel like for the most part, this NES game was the template for the other console versions, even if they were, in the case of the Super NES game, made by a different developer.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's still, they're all pretty much the same. You are the Red October. You are surrounded by a bloodthirsty army of submarines and airplanes and surface ships and I don't know, are there giant squid or something at some point? I think there is in the Super NES game.
Yes.
yeah. At some point you have to fight Captain Nemo probably. I don't know. It's all pretty much the same thing, just with varying degrees of friendliness.
Yeah. I will say the NES game has like cutscenes or cinema scenes, as we might say, certain elements of the movie in there, not a lot of them or anything. It's like a couple, they're sort of bookended in the middle, but
surely
there's like the actual movie-like scenes in it.
Yeah, surely the Hunt for October NES must be the only 8-bit game that has a likeness of Robert Jordan in it. It's gotta be.
Yeah, gotta be. So it's on the short list for sure.
I mean, it's gotta be the only game that lets you play as Sean Connery, maybe ever. Has there ever been a game where you can play as Sean Connery? I guess GoldenEye multiplayer?
That was good.
Did they get Connery's likeness? No?
I'm trying to think of games based on The Last Crusade. But
they did the one game about From Russia with Love, like many years later.
Oh, so
that's
right.
That's one.
Okay, but there you go. The newer, all right. No.
Even that's young Sean Connery. This has got to be old Sean Connery.
Right.
Yeah. It's also kind of funny that the Sean Connery sprite in this game just... His suit just looks pure black, so he looks more like James Bond than anything else.
Yes, he does. But he's got a full white head of hair and a full beard.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't have enough resolution on the NES to get those blue and white stripes that the Russian sailors wear on their undershirts.
And in typical...
You
know,
there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, and in typical movie game fashion or Euro-adjacent game design, you know, two-thirds of the screen is UI HUD.
Of course.
In that sequence, that is the platforming sequence.
Yeah, I think it was a beating heart to represent his life.
Of course,
yeah,
and also his feelings for his departed wife.
Yeah, also represented by the beating heart. Yeah, because it's a cartoon like Valentine Heart.
Yeah. Yes,
innovators. I'm telling you, they don't make them like they used to.
All right, so let's move along and talk about the Game Boy game, which. Actually, to me, kind of feels like the most reasonable of these, even though you have the smallest screen resolution. It moves at a slower pace, and therefore, to me, feels a little more manageable.
I agree with you. I think, you and I are kind of like pretty big Game Boy fans to begin with. So
true.
In that sense, I'm kind of partial to this. Like, I don't hate this version. Some of the good parts about it is that it retains the radar at the bottom. And like, that's kind of wild. Like they actually managed to fit in the little mini map there and it is helpful still. So I was like, oh, this is nice. I do think the levels kind of drag on. They're a bit too long, but at the same time, I feel that's okay for like a Game Boy game because at least it's not too short, like a lot of Game Boy games. And in the sense, again, just sort of this Game Boy philosophy, you can use it to mindlessly kill some time.
Right. So. Yeah, I mean, have you ever played Super Mario Land? God, what a nothing of a game. Those tiny little levels, and there's only like 8 of them. Gosh.
In that defense, it took me a few tries to beat it when I was little. So, you know, Super Mario Land, I'm not calling it out or anything, but some games the Konami ones. Yeah, there was early Konami games. Too short, I'd say. And so, that's my general view of it. It's that you're mostly just going through these underwater levels again, just going around the canyons, I suppose. And again, just shooting guys that come in. And again, it just sounds so simple. And it even is more simplified than the NES version, as some may even expect. But it's not bad for some reason. I don't hate it. I could deal with it.
I think it's more focused. I think it's more focused, and I think that works to its strength. Like, it's just a sub combat. Like, there's no cutscenes this time around. There's no platforming thing with the finale. It's just like, here you are in a submarine. It doesn't matter. What are you fighting in the submarine? I don't know. At one point, you seem to be fighting like a giant like undersea rig at some point. I don't know what that is, but like, okay, you know,
you're attempting to cripple
the most Game Boy minded.
Attempting to cripple Western Europe's energy resources by taking out the North Sea oil rigs. That's my thought. You're kind of leveling both sides. We're taking away the Soviets, you know, first strike weapon, but also Europe is going to have a really cold winter. So, yeah. You know, everyone's reduced to zero. It's like how Anakin brought balance to the Force by getting rid of all the Jedi and the Sith.
Yeah.
Anyway.
One and done.
Okay. So stupid jokes aside, how about the Super NES game? It's the most complex, and I think that works against it.
Yeah, I would place it kind of in between the NES and Game Boy ones. Does that sound reasonable?
I actually like it less than the NES one. The NES one is like really hard. But the Super NES one, I feel like you have to face endless waves of enemies. You have limited ammunition for a lot of your weapons, and you have to worry about which direction you're facing. Yeah. So enemies are a lot more prone to attack you from behind. And on the NES version, unless I'm missing something, you can't turn around, can you? It's pretty much just a single direction scroller. Whereas in this one, you have to like hit the shoulder buttons and you'll reverse your direction. Otherwise, you're just taking damage from behind. And you can't do anything about it. So
Plus,
you just
have
super punishing.
Plus, you have the Super NES controller, and they use every button has a weapon. Essentially, you don't just get a vertical torpedo and then a horizontal torpedo. It's like you get the little lob grenade type thing, which makes no sense underwater, but so be it. it's they use every button. And you have a lot of, I mean, again, sort of thing where, okay, I get more weapons, but I also have more weapons to keep track of ammo-wise. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And it does seem a bit more manic. Like, there's more guys coming after you at every moment. And it's just, it's much easier to die, much quicker to die, I'd say, in this version.
Yeah. So it turns out only the first level is based on the story, The Hunt for Red October. Yeah. And then after that... It's like, here's the ship that we scuttled, but before we destroyed it, here are the cool missions that it went on secretly for the U.S. Navy, I guess. I don't know, but I can't actually make it past the first level of this game, so I've never seen any of this firsthand.
They all pretty much blend together, all the levels. But yeah, it's funny that level one is basically the synopsis of the movie. Just defect to the United States. Okay, done. Thank you. On to the next stage, which is, I don't know, the battle record, like maybe you were saying, like, let's explore the full potential of the Red October in these missions. Yeah.
Akai October Senki.
Yes. But yeah, this was a different developer. This came out in 93, so like way after everything else. They fit in Super Scope support because there are these bonus stages where you can do this first-person view sort of shooting gallery thing, like, you know, 98%
like
of the
periscope,
other Super
Scope, basically?
I guess. I mean, you don't get to see that in all its glory, but it's like the other Super Scope games, like the the base level documented version of a Super Scope game, which is like, shoot down these things that are coming at you. And you can use the controller, of course. You don't need the Super Scope, but it is funny that they just decided to support it because it's 1993, I guess, on Super Nintendo. And it's just not very good. It's just straightforward shooting stuff. I will say also this game's big failing compared to all the other ones that there's no mini-map this time. This developer chose to not put in the mini-map. And like I said, it is just so much more crazy from the get-go. You kind of need it. It would, I mean, maybe not need it. It would certainly help. I would feel more comfortable if I had a mini map in this game where I could see some other things coming from above. That'd be nice. But gosh.
And yet, Ray, they went to the trouble to make that giant map of the world for the briefing scene where they tell you where your next mission is every time. And that's where you get all this flavor text that explains your outrageous sequence of missions where you're destroying arm dealers, you're escorting VIPs, you fight a giant squid. I think the last level is like putting down a coup d'etat in Moscow. Like you sail your submarine into Moscow and take out the junta, I guess. I don't know.
Is this based on Yeltsin's, like, the rebellion that he pushed back against?
I don't know.
Ripped from the headlines.
If you watch it on YouTube and you see the ending, it ends with this sort of, you know, waving sprite of Ramius sort of waving to a giant crowd, but it's only from the back. So it's like, Sean Connery's face is on the box of the game, but if you play the game and get to the end, all you see is his back. It's waving.
Yeah, they ran out of likeness rights money.
Yeah, no kidding.
So funny.
Yeah, they should have called it Red October, the Yeltsin missions.
Yeltsin guided.
I have one last comment, though.
Okay, yes.
Sorry.
Compared to the other versions, this game has like vaporwave album cover colors. Like it's really bright and vibrant.
Oh, yeah.
Like, especially even for a Super NES game, I mean, this could almost pass, I think, for a Japanese game in terms of some of the aesthetic choices they make in this. Like, the graphics are just kind of not what you would expect, I think, from a Red October game. I expected something a lot more dark, and I didn't get that. It's like teal oceans and bright orange skies and stuff, and like purple canyons and things.
Although the outlines on the sprites are more like European PC type design, like the sprites look very Amiga like, and at first I thought this was based on an Amiga game, but looking around, it doesn't appear to be the case. So it's just one of those things.
Yeah, I think the developers were American.
Rydell Software Productions, RSP.
Yeah,
Rydell. Like, I don't know how to pronounce that.
Americans like the Amiga too,
of course.
Anyway, so that has been The Hunt for Red October, and I'm afraid we lied. We did not explain the plot of the movie and the book to you. After all, we danced around it. So once again, you'll just have to go and spend 2 hours of your life watching a really fun, punchy, enjoyable movie. I'm so sorry to do that to you. This episode just won't make sense to you unless you watch a very entertaining piece of Hollywood entertainment. So that's our regret as Retronauts. We made you watch a movie. Anyway, thank you both for your time and your thoughts on this compact little slice of video game history and the sort of bigger picture topic type discussion. And, once again, a very suitable theme being political for this year of politics. So I know our readers appreciate that kind of timeliness. You're all welcome. Anyway, thank you both for your time. Ray, please give us your bona fides. As soon as I tell people that if they have enjoyed this episode, they can listen to so many more by going to patreon.com/retronauts, because this podcast is about 95% patron supported, maybe a little more. We do have some advertisements on the public feed occasionally, and that's why you should support us on Patreon, because if you support us, then you get to listen to every episode a week in advance with a higher bitrate quality and with no advertisements of any sort, and that's cool. So I highly recommend it. Also, if you pay $5 a month instead of $3, you get really an embarrassment of riches, like tons of content every month, just tons of stuff, including contributions by our own Diamond Fight here. So please go to patreon.com/retronauts and support us, and we'll keep making podcasts like this and also podcasts that are less political. Ray, please give us your bona fides as requested before.
All right. Well, real quick, I do want to say there are some great submarine video games out there. So don't let this movie game turn you off or anything. There is, of course, like Sub-Rebellion on PS2 from IREM. There is a PS1 game called Submarine Commander. It was only released in Japan and PAL regions, but it's an anime-tinged sort of like Ace Combat, but with submarines. It has like a plot to it. It has some more technical gameplay and shooting stuff as well. So it's actually kind of neat that way. Those are two good examples. But yeah,
where just, do you stand on Radar Mission?
I have not played that too much, actually. But I don't remember anything about it. Sorry.
I would say it's probably a better submarine game on Game Boy than Hunt for Red October.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And of course, those Steel Diver games that Nintendo made, yeah.
They used to be free, but now the 3DS is gone.
Oh, boy. But yeah, my website is rdbaaa.space. You can find all the links to my social stuff there and all the other creative things that I'm putting out. Nothing much to report lately, so I'll just direct you there and keep track of me. Say hi. Thanks very much. And of course, my podcast, No More Whoppers, you can also find that way.
Yeah, well, it was great having you on. Thanks for taking the time. Phyto-san, where would your things on the internet be?
I'll tell you, but first, Ray, please tell us, what's the name of that game you made with the explosions in it?
Oh, that's right. Blast Rush. Yes, of course. Thank you. I got to say, the explosions are not that great, but I mean, they are well made. I did make sure to get the best possible explosions I could get for my money. But I'm saying in terms of like programming the effects of them, I'd say the NES game did it better than I could have. Certainly the artist who made the explosions in the game. Great job. So yes, check that out. Yeah, you can go to my game company site, bipedal.dog. To find links to those games. Yeah. But yes, thank you, Fight, for keeping me honest on that.
Yeah. You're an explosion connoisseur. We need to respect that.
Exactly. Got to make sure it's just right.
Anyway, if you want to find me on the internet, you can go to my website, which I made myself. So it looks like it came out in 1995. Go to fightclub.me. F-E-I-T is my last name. C-L-U-B. That's a word you already know. .me, because Fight Club is me.
And if you are listening to this episode the day that it shows up on Patreon, congratulations. Tomorrow you can come to Midwest Gaming Classic and see both myself and Fight and some other people, such as Bob and Nadia, talking about old video games, specifically about Final Fantasy VI. So please check that out. And if you are not listening in time to make it to the show tomorrow, then that's okay, because that podcast, that presentation will go online as a podcast. So you'll be able to enjoy it that way. As for myself, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet as Jeremy Parrish, except on Blue Sky, where I am just jparrish.bluesky or bsky, whatever. Yes, anyway, I'm on Blue Sky. That's where I mostly post. But also, I do Retronauts and stuff with Limited Run Games and videos on my YouTube channel. Haven't made it to Hunt for Red October yet, but give me a few years. And otherwise, I'll be on lots of Retronauts episodes, so check back soon for more of those. And of course, a Midwest Gaming Classic, if you can make it. Anyway, that is it for this episode of Retronauts. As you once trembled at the sound of our podcasting, so now shall you tremble at the sound of our silence.
Das Vidanya.
That wasn't silent, Fight.
I'm sorry. I got to say goodbye.
Man, just cut it out.